From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowen in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Puerto Rican writer Irena Villar talks about trying to come to terms with her family and its three-generation history with depression and despair. Villar, alternating between notes she took while in a psychiatric ward and her own family history notes, tries to come to terms with what happened in her family. Also, when technology bites back, Edward Tenner fires a salvo, warning us about some of the unintended consequences of technology. Commentator Milo Miles reviews music from the father of juju music, a form popular in Africa in the 60s, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest film in the public television series POV. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. White House officials continue to criticize Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole's economic plan. They hope to deny Dole the boost he might enjoy from voters interested in the plan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
So far, the response of the White House is criticism, not counterproposal. Administration aides say the president has already proposed a series of targeted middle-class tax cuts paid for with spending reductions. The president may propose at least one more, a capital gains tax cut for homeowners. White House officials from the president on down are attacking Dole's proposal as pie in the sky. But the White House is clearly nervous about the potential political appeal of the Dole plan. One senior campaign aide said yesterday that polls show voters prefer the president's targeted tax cuts to an across-the-board break, but only after voters hear about the downsides of tax cuts that are not paid for. The Dole plan has broad appeal, this official says, but you can undermine it once you explain the consequences. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Libya says the new U.S. law punishing foreign firms that do business in Libya and Iran is a, quote, demonstration of hatred and selfishness. Libya warns the law will backfire against the United States. The new law specifically punishes firms that do business in the energy sectors of Libya or Iran. It requires U.S. sanctions on these firms that invest at least $40 million a year. Fragments from the Olympic Park explosion in Atlanta have been found in bombing suspect Richard Jewell's apartment. Jewell's lawyer says the material is a souvenir. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports from Atlanta.
Attorney G. Watson Bryant says the shrapnel was given to his client by Olympic guards a few days after the tragedy. Watson also confirmed it was part of the blown-up bomb that killed one person and injured more than 100 others in Centennial Park July 27th. Richard Jewell has been questioned repeatedly in connection with the blast, but no charges have been filed. The FBI has taken Jewell's fingerprints and hair samples, but at his lawyer's advice, Jewell has refused to give them voice samples. They've also searched the apartment he shares with his mother and a cabin he used in the North Georgia mountains when he was a deputy sheriff. Jewell's defense team has also been joined by prominent Atlanta criminal defense attorney Jack Martin. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
The United States will soon bring home families of government workers in Saudi Arabia. The move comes after two fatal terror bombings in recent months. The latest in June killed 19 American airmen at a U.S. military barracks in Dahran. There's no indication of how many U.S. dependents will return to the United States. They are not being forced to leave, but if they decide to come home, the United States will pay for their travel. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 23 points at 5,651. The Nasdaq is down a fraction of a point at 1,120. This is NPR. The United Nations Security Council is considering an appeal from Croatia's eastern Slavonia region for $10 million. It's the last mainly Croatian Serb area of Croatia. Linda Fasulo reports from New York.
5,000 UN peacekeepers are deployed in eastern Slavonia, and the United Nations is temporarily administering the area until it reverts to Croatia next year. But now, Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali is warning of growing social unrest there due to Zagreb's failure to fully pay local Serb civil servants, such as teachers, police, firefighters, and health workers. Many are owed a month's wages. In a letter to the Security Council, Boutros-Ghali says about $2 million per month is needed for such expenses, and is urging the council to come up with enough money to cover the rest of 1996. Otherwise, he says, what has been a successful mission could be in jeopardy. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
Firefighters are battling blazes in six western states. Officials say they aren't able to get all the aerial tankers and helicopters they need to fight the flames in Utah, California, Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, and Nevada. The biggest blaze is in Utah, where 100,000 acres have burned. A fast-moving fire west of Reno, Nevada, forced authorities to evacuate most of the town of Mogul yesterday. They were also forced to close down Interstate 80. It's an airfare war. The latest rates to fly are even getting lower. A traveler can fly from coast to coast and then back again for as little as $200. America West Airlines started it yesterday. The move has been matched by United, American, Delta, and TWA on selected routes. But the new fares have strict requirements. Customers must buy round-trip tickets on night flights at least 3 days in advance. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. On March 1, 1954, a Puerto Rican nationalist named Lolita Lebron and three other protesters opened fire in the U.S. House of Representatives. Five members of Congress were wounded. 23 years later, Lebron's daughter, Gladys Mendez, committed suicide by throwing herself out of a moving car. Her 8-year-old daughter tried in vain to restrain her. That child, Irena Villar, tried to kill herself 10 years later while she was attending college in New York. This legacy of self-destruction is the subject of Irena Villar's new memoir, A Message from God in the Atomic Age. The title is taken from a prison letter her grandmother wrote to President Eisenhower. In the book, Villar explores the political and personal circumstances that led each of these women, including herself, to consider their own deaths. In trying to piece together her family's history, she said she ran into many stories about what had happened. I asked her for the version she heard about her grandmother and what she had done in the U.S. House.
At the beginning, when I didn't know much, I would have people tell me she was a terrorist. Even friends who had their own specified ideas of what terrorism was. Others would just say that she was a martyr. Others would say she was a heroine. So it took me some time to realize she wasn't a terrorist, that terrorism is based on chaos and on fear and on unpredictability and the uncertainty of its origins. And she actually dressed up for the occasion, you know. She kind of draped herself in the Puerto Rican flag and went and faced what seemed to be the dress of power, the congressman.
So she went in with her friends. They sat in the gallery. Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
Then I believe they were about to take a vote. The congressmen were about to take a vote on a bill about letting farm workers from Mexico come in, and I believe they waited for that moment in which they stood up, the no's and yays, and at that moment she stood up and put the flag around her body and just shouted, Viva Puerto Rico. And then her companions began to shoot, and she also began to shoot.
How many people were wounded?
Six. Well, many, but basically six were critically wounded.
And then because they stood up and made themselves very obvious, did the police, the guards descend on them?
Yes, it was so easy. It was like, you know, like going into a big trap. They just stood there and kept shooting and reloading. And at that moment, when people kind, you know, the congressman heard, you know, Viva Mexico, since the context was something else, or maybe Hollywood, I don't know. But it was a moment of great confusion from what I've researched and asked. But it took very little time for the guards to come in and just take over.
Now, what was her trial like? And she was, in the end, sentenced to more than 50 years in prison. Can you describe the trial for us?
57 years. There is one moment in which kind of summarizes her whole frame of mind and her disposition through that trial. And it was when she was going out of one of the first trials. She faced two of them, but the first one, a reporter asked her, how did she feel about her children? She had a girl, then a boy. my mother and my uncle, who was still alive. He died a few months after that. But anyway, she answered, it is painful now for them because they're children, but when they grow up, it would be more important for them to be free than to have a mother. And this is why I'm doing this now.
Did your grandmother ever say she regretted what she did?
Yes, yes. She doesn't regret the years in prison. She doesn't regret the life she gave to the struggle, or what she sees as the struggle. She does regret the bloody part of it. She's a pacifist, and she's a very religious Catholic woman. And she lately has kind of directed her struggle into that more religious side of things.
I'm speaking with Irena Vilar, and her book is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. It's a memoir, the story of her grandmother, whom we've just been talking about, who opened fire in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1954, sentenced to prison, now lives in Puerto Rico, where she was born. The book is also about my guest's mother, who later committed suicide, and, of course, my guest herself, who has attempted suicide. Well, let's talk a little bit about your mother. Now, when she was born, your grandmother left her in Puerto Rico so that she could go to the United States. Why do you think she felt she couldn't take her own daughter with her?
I think she had a very ambivalent relationship to this baby because it was born out of not of a love relationship, but more out of a bartering relationship with a rich man that had kind of given them a home after her father had died. So it was a kind of, you know, kind of selling of, and this baby was very, very ambivalent for her. And I think she left it. She was young. She was only 20. And after she got to New York, then she became involved with the party. She wasn't involved before. She was just a writer. She was a poet. She had a very difficult life, very poor life in the countryside. And when she got to New York, she met people. She got involved with the seamstress in New York City, trying to organize them. She met very interesting people that directed her that were struggling then in New York City. And little by little, I think that abandonment became justified in other ways. But I think the origins of that leaving my mother was much more complex and much more, perhaps, for her, shameful to admit. But I think it's very rich, yeah.
Who took care of your mother?
Her grandmother. My grandmother's mother.
So your great-grandmother.
Exactly.
Then raised your mother.
Yes.
You mentioned the word abandonment, which, of course, is a very strong word. Do you feel, then, that your grandmother abandoned your mother?
I don't necessarily feel that, but I know that's what the way my mother felt. I know that from the things I witnessed through her, through the melancholy she had, and through her efforts to justify that, through her own involvement in the party, through trying to free her and work with people back in Puerto Rico to build support to free her mother. But basically, deep inside, there was a sense of abandonment.
Well, you're the youngest of four children, the only daughter. What kind of mother was she to you?
She was a very... she was marvelous. She was very sweet. We were together constantly, always. I was more than a daughter. I was a witness because I went everywhere with her. And I was also her, like her shield, you know, when she had her own affairs. I was her shield. So I was many things for her. But towards me, I got a lot of love, but a lot of ambiguities, too.
Well, I want to have you read a section from your memoir, and this is actually written about leaving your brother's wedding. And at the wedding, your father had been dancing with a younger woman, and the year is 1977. Can you read that section for us?
Uh-huh. It goes, "My brother Cheito's wedding was anything but heaven for Mama. So long, Papa said, getting in behind the wheel. Uncle Miguel didn't take his eyes off Mama. Drive carefully, he said. Take it easy, he stressed. Papa, with his usual optimism, declared that everything was going to be all right. He started the engine and we took off in the Mazda. We were returning home on the 27th of February, 1977. I don't know if they said anything to each other. Mama stayed in the same position, maintaining the same silence with which she'd gotten in, and I, who'd seen Uncle Miguel's worried face, was keeping watch in the back seat, sort of preparing myself for what was to come. In the shadows of the car, all I could see of her was the gold purse. She was clutching it with both hands. Papa was looking straight ahead. He was still looking ahead when we went through the main gate, and that's how he was during the whole trip, straight ahead. As if there was still time to stop everything, I look back. I look for the church where my brother had just gotten married, and I saw Uncle Miguel still standing there with the undecided expression of someone who knows that something is going to happen. Was he imagining it? I've got to look after her, I said to myself, and I took her arm firmly as if to tell her I wouldn't abandon her. She turned around. She had the look of someone who was very tired. I let go, but from my back seat, I kept on watching her. Her eyes were enlarged, empty. Go to sleep, she ordered. It was the last thing she ever said to me.
Both you and your uncle had this idea of something was going to happen next. And what happened was that she threw herself out of the car. Both you and your father then took her to the hospital. Her head was on your lap, and she died. You write, she'd done what she wanted to do. She left me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you felt? That she had, that this was a personal thing, that she had left you?
I think that, that in that section, the point of view is more the point of view of the child,
right,
which the whole world centers around that mother, and for whom she's sacred. She's God. I mean, that child has no idea of religion or of God beyond that mother.
When the police investigated the accident, you said that she'd fallen asleep against the door, which opened. Did you feel you wanted to protect your mother?
Yes. You know, many times I've asked myself why I so spontaneously came up with that lie, and probably I think that as a child, even within my ignorance, I knew that what happened was wrong, and I tried to make it look fine. I tried to make it again all right, and it was not only my mother but my father. I sensed somehow too that my father was part of it and that it was directed towards my father. So. And I loved dearly my father, so I also wanted to protect him.
Well, Irina Vilar, we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Irina Vilar. Her book is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age, and it's a memoir of three generations of her family. Her grandmother opened fire in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1954 and was sentenced to 57 years of prison. She served 29 of those years. Her mother committed suicide when my guest was a little girl, and my guest, Irina Vilar, attempted suicide several times. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Irina Vilar, and her book is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. When do you think you became unglued, if I can use that word? And I want to have you actually read a section from the book after we hear the answer to that. But when you look back over your life then, do you have a clue about when things started to go wrong for you?
Yes, I think they had started to go wrong for a long time. I think that as a child, when my mother died and kind of desacralized my life, I had enough good things inside, thanks to some luck I had by having all these uncles and aunts and my father. I was a lucky child, I think, in many ways, that somehow were able to make me just keep going. But I did it by just kind of forgetting. I mean, I did it mourn. I didn't mourn. It was just like, she died, okay, I'll just fix the house and start from scratch. And that, I think that helped me for a long time because the horror of that experience, and that's part of the trauma, just, you know, it was too horrifying. And it helped me to keep going. But then at age 18, that technique, you know, doesn't help you anymore because the problems are different. And I think that when I became a senior and many things started to coincide, also I was coming of age and I was starting to be a woman. I was making love. I was knowing what a body is in many other ways. So a lot of things started to coincide and my mother became a recourse.
Well, I want to have you read another section from the book, and this is something that you write about a time you were 18 years old, and it's in the middle of winter.
Mm-hmm. I'd just moved into a house on Buckingham Street, and that day I'd begun to fix a place up. I'd stopped going to my literature classes. On Sunday, January 31st, I opened the boxes and found Mama's picture. It was the last photograph taken of her. I'd carried that picture with me ever since I was a little girl. Everything, sadness, death, and even the chipness of the metal frame informed that photograph and its absurd proportions. I wanted to hang it on one of the walls. After all, that woman of clear beauty was my mother. I could hear the rain beating on the roof of the balcony, and I could also hear my mother's voice in the sound of the rain, and something in my blood made the connection. And while I was standing on a chair, struggling to straighten out the picture, my mother's voice persisted. I shouldn't have been hearing that voice. Things hadn't been going well for me lately, and the refuge I needed was somewhere else. Perhaps in my index cards. I had been shuttling between the library and my room, armed with index cards that were becoming increasingly oppressive. But Mama's overpowering voice went on. Hundreds of voices sprang from hers, talked among themselves, spoke to me, about me, on my behalf, voices from my index cards, the illusion of a busy life. Notes for a diary I would one day turn into a critical book about three sirens or cycles, the child, the nymph, the old lady, three generations of women in my family. But what I imagined was a clever project was fast becoming a chaos of 3x5 cards I couldn't bother to read because they brimmed with pride, wanton self-assertiveness, self-conscious family epigrams, too glorious to be taken seriously now that I could barely stand on my own feet. As I stepped down from the chair, the other voices faded away, but Mama's went on. It started to invade me, to get inside me. It said, "Hurry up, Irene. You can only be one of us."
You took a mixture of pills and vodka, and you described that early sensation of suicide, really, as a kind of vertigo. Do you remember the sensations, the feelings of what it was like when the pills and the vodka took effect?
Yes, there is so much that gets mixed with those images because there's also images that are yours, but there are also images that come from so many places, from movies, from TV, from books. And they all get mixed up, giving you even more the feeling that you're nothing, that you're a fake, that even your own death is not yours, you know? So I do recall that feeling nothing all the way to the end, feeling that not even that act was mine, that even that act was a reenactment. And basically, it was a reenactment. It was a repetition of my mother's act.
You talked about the fact that these index cards that you were keeping as a way of, I guess, writing down the the facts of your life that in part these were the words and memories that were driving you crazy. And yet here you've written a book, drawn, I assume, to some degree on these index cards that you kept. Was there something about being able to finally write this story down which helped you bring some kind of order and sanity to your life?
Yes, very much. The book, see, I always wrote in, but again, in bits and pieces. I until that moment, that critical moment in my life, writing was more undirected. I kind of lacked an organizing principle. I lacked organization and purpose. So this crisis and all that happened in it and after it gave me a wound where to write from, basically. I knew where the wound was, and I knew that it could give me a lot of material to organize those cards. And that not only was my story, but it was the story of these other two characters, and that through them, many other stories could also be told. So it's a memoir, but it's more than a memoir, it's a testimony, because it's a point of view of the witness.
Well, you say that your mother's death may be your redemption. Are you any more certain today after you wrote those words?
Yes, I mean, to the extent. I mean, the phrase itself has the price of poeticity, but you know, as there is a part of it that is very truth, which is that she offered me an image of fragility enough loss that I feel privileged to have, you know. Many people go through their lives with nothing more lacking than not having seen the basketball game the day before. I don't know to what extent that redeems you or not. So I think that, I mean, it's just out there for questioning.
Well, Irena Villar, I thank you very much for joining us today in Fresh Air. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Irena Villar's memoir is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why things bite back. Edward Tenner warns us about unintended negative consequences of technology. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Taken for a Ride, a documentary about public transportation on the PBS series POV. This is Fresh Air. Music critic Milo Miles has a tribute to the late Nigerian master of juju music, LK Dairo. Milo says he was a virtuoso instrumentalist and brilliant arranger. At his peak in the 1960s, Dairo was one of the most popular band leaders in Africa.
By the most basic measure, Isaiah Kehinde Dairo was an overwhelming influence on his style of music. All the juju bands that came after him sound more like his groups than they sound like anybody else, and he went through a classic folk musician struggle to the top. He joined his first band in 1942 when he was 12, but that didn't last long. Dairo worked as a barber, cloth trader, and carpenter for years, playing his accordion and running juju groups on the side. The outfit that finally clicked was called the Blue Spots, and the hit that really put them over the top was called Salome. Heard now, 24 years after its release, Salome shows a first-class pop music sensibility at work. Even with all the cultural barriers it has to cross to American ears, it still sounds vivid, lean, and indelible.
Salome o wu mi o Tu ba je tu ma te pa ma che ro wo mi o Salome o da lo bi iwa re lo wu mi o Salome ele ju ege eyi fun jowo Salome eyi menu ku o oyibo Salome
Juju expert Christopher Waterman has pointed out how Dairo appealed to many audiences. While accordion was his first love, he could turn out mean licks on guitar as well. A fervent Christian, Dairo built melodies from church hymns. These would be prominent in the first and last sections of his songs. In the middle, he would mix in Cuban rumba and specific drumming from the Yoruba people. Plus, Dairo wrote in a half dozen languages. He wanted everybody to listen and compared the Blue Spots to rain. If you stepped outside, they would fall on you. In the middle 60s, rabid Dairo fans called him a sensible hedonist and praised the booming of the band which cracks the brain and which forces dumb legs to move even if unwilling. Ah, but fame is fickle. By the late 70s, Dairo had been displaced by younger performers such as Ebenezer Obey and King Sunny Ade, who called one of his early groups the Green Spot Band in honor of Dairo. Before too long, Dairo's old accordion parts were being played on synthesizers, and he was imitating his former imitators. However, he always sounded strong and sweet. Discouraged, Dairo took long breaks from performing, but in his last years he enjoyed a bit of a revival, even touring the United States a couple times. Two vigorous, clearly recorded selections of his latter-day work are available on CD. One is called Asiko, which features a tough remake of Salome, and the other is I Remember, which benefits from a fuller band accompaniment. Those who want to go right to the source should check out Juju Master I.K. Dairo MBE, The Glory Years. Aided by John Storm Roberts' brisk liner notes, this collection delivers the tunes that made Dairo a star in 22 tight bursts. Yes, he still cracks the brain and gets those dumb legs dancing.
Milo Miles writes about music from Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is Fresh Air. Technology is designed to make life better. Well, that's the idea, but according to my guest, Edward Tenner, often there are unintended downsides from technological advances. He calls them revenge effects and details them in his new book, Why Things Bite Back. For instance, Tenner writes, sports equipment designed to protect football players from serious injury actually encourages more reckless play, making football an even more dangerous sport. The kudzu vine was supposed to protect the soil in the southwest, but it has overrun the place. And computers were supposed to cut down on paper use, but we all know that offices are awash with paper. I asked Tenner if Americans have always believed that technology would solve all our problems.
We didn't start to think of technology in the present way until the early 19th century, even though in some cases there was a lot of technological sophistication, for example, in mining, in shipbuilding, and other fields. The reason for that, I've argued, is that only in the early 19th century did technology really become a matter of systems. And whenever you have systems, you have the possibility of unexpected interactions among the components that lead to a result that nobody had foreseen. I argue that the Frankenstein story, if you read it closely, is really a very early example of this. And I also point out that the first use of the word bug was among telegraphers. And these people were the 19th century's high-tech nerds. They had a culture very similar to that of programmers today, amazingly similar. Thomas Edison came out of that culture. Telegraphers referred to the mysterious problems in their system as bugs.
Again, tell us what you mean by that word, revenge effects.
I mean that it is, I mean that these are effects not just that present some kind of disadvantage from using the technology, but these are ways in which human behavior and the technology itself interact to offset or cancel out our reason for using it. One example that I give is filter tip cigarettes. And the studies of filter tip smokers that show that they are actually blocking the air holes that really dilute the smoke. It isn't that the filter is that magical thing, but it's really the extra air. And consciously or unconsciously, they block these holes. They also tend to smoke more. They inhale more deeply. So the idea of a safer cigarette is something that, because of these revenge effects, looks very, very doubtful.
And this is an example of obviously an invention that was supposed to solve a particular problem, deliver less tar to the smoker.
Yes.
But the unintended consequences is that people, I guess, assume, well, I can just smoke a low-tar cigarette and I don't need to worry about getting cancer.
That's right. Another even more interesting and subtle case is the use of sunblockers and the confidence that people have staying in the sun longer. The problem is that nearly all the sunblock preparations now in use block only ultraviolet B. And so people may get more exposure to ultraviolet A, which has serious health consequences of its own, may promote aging of the skin and so forth. And so quite a few medical people have urged against too much reliance on sunblocker, the sunblockers now in use.
Well, you begin your book talking a lot about the computer, and certainly the computer has made many, many promises. And in many ways, as you said, even writing for you is easier because of a computer, and that's certainly true for me as well. But there was this promise of this paperless office, of everyone on their computers sending email back and forth and talking to each other, and all the trees of the world would stand upright. What happened?
That's one of the most fascinating cases and one of the things actually that started me writing the book. People didn't realize a couple of things, very important things. They didn't realize that computer terminals were not going to improve as rapidly as they thought. Today, most people are still working with a computer screen that isn't terribly different, except that it has color, from the screens that were in use when the IBM PC was first brought on the market. So there is a limit to what you can read on that for many reasons. You can read only about two screens at a time before you get fatigued. And so the natural thing for longer documents with graphics, of course, is to go ahead and print it. And then, of course, the sense of security that somebody has in having that document black and white. It isn't enough to have a magnetic backup. You can lose that backup. So the safest backup seems to be ink on paper.
Well, one of the other promises, of course, of the computerized office was greater productivity. And again, I wonder what the unintended consequences of that have been.
The productivity gains can be very real. They have been real in some organizations, but there are so many pitfalls that a lot of places really have fallen short. One of them is just the amount of time that it takes to learn software, to fix hardware, and the amount of peer time that's required to make computers work. One of the things that happens in offices sometimes is that somebody who is in a much higher salary bracket is the person who knows how to make a certain program work. And that person may spend quite a bit of his or her time helping some colleague in a less specialized, lower salaried position with a program. Now, that doesn't show up on the computing department's bill. That's a kind of hidden cost. But that's time that could have been spent getting a new client or preparing some document that could have made the organization work better. And it's very hard to trace, but the studies that have been done show that this is a real problem.
Well, let's focus a little bit more on medicine. You have several chapters, discrete chapters, and one of them certainly looks at health and medicine. And I guess the quote you use is doing better but feeling worse. And it's clear that there have been all sorts of advances in medicine. But what are the revenge effects we're dealing with?
The big one is the shift from acute to chronic illness. And this is, in fact, the basis for a lot of the other analysis in my book, because as I began to study revenge effects, one of the things that struck me was how often, apart from the medical area as such, people were tending to use technology to change an acute problem into a chronic one. The chronic one was really less severe than what it had replaced, but because it was harder to deal with, people resented it more or feared it more. A good example is the nature of workmen's compensation claims and industrial problems. If you look at a railroad, national railroad timetable from about 1915 or so, it is filled with ads for artificial limb manufacturers. There were many really very severely disabling accidents in that early 20th century industrial environment. What we've been able to do through automation and safety devices is to reduce significantly the rate of those. Likewise, in the automobile, treating automobile accidents, preventing automobile accidents, generally the rate of accidents and injuries per million miles traveled has declined, even though the absolute numbers of injuries may not show that. The more people drive, actually, the safer driving becomes socially. However, on the other side, we have carpal tunnel syndrome. We have back problems, and back problems are now the most important source of workmen's compensation claims, and they are really much harder to treat than other injuries because we really don't know what causes them.
So what you're saying is in the past someone would get killed on the job, and now because things are safer on the job, people don't necessarily get killed at the rates they were in the past, but they hurt themselves.
That's right.
And then they get a chronic injury that they have to then deal with in their very long life, because it seems to me that all part of this, one of the good news is that people are living longer.
Yes.
But what happens when you live longer is that you oftentimes have to deal with lots of aches and pains, chronic health problems.
Yes, an aging population is one that is inevitably will have more chronic health problems.
Okay, and I guess that in a nutshell is really what you're talking about when talking about the revenge effect, seeing all the positive benefits of advances in health, but of course seeing the consequences as well.
Yes, I think it's also due to the fact that we had been accustomed to rapid improvements in the treatment of acute illness. One of the striking examples that I mention in the book is the rate of recovery from military wounds how it has increased in every American war since the Spanish-American War, which actually per 1,000 troop days of fighting was the war with the greatest number of casualties in American history. And in every war, just cumulatively, under the pressure of battle, under the pressure of emergencies, the ability to treat emergencies, acute injuries, has increased tremendously. After the Vietnam War, for example, you had a whole new generation of emergency room doctors who were able to save people under circumstances that in which they would otherwise be lost. So there's a kind of positive, there are positive paradoxes too, that sometimes the most terrible things, the sinking of the Titanic, for example, perhaps this crash in Florida, can lead to important new safety measures. But when you get into the chronic sphere, you have a much harder time finding a miracle cure, a magic bullet. You can develop palliatives, you can find all kinds of ways to make people more comfortable, but you don't get that satisfaction of a cure. And that, to me, accounts for a lot of the dissatisfaction.
You raised some interesting questions having to do with the development of safety features. Obviously, we don't want people to get hurt doing what appear to be rather dangerous sports like football. And yet there are some unintended consequences. And just give us an example if you can.
One of the most striking examples of technology and sports has been the effect of gloves on boxing.
Right.
19th century bare-knuckle prize fighting could be extremely bloody, really brutal. But it was self-limiting in a way because the fighters didn't want to break their fists landing a blow. In the late 19th century, boxing promoters wanted to attract a more middle-class clientele. They wanted to clean the game up and make it look more respectable. And gloves were one of the innovations that let them do this. They actually had been used by middle-class sparrers, boxers earlier, but now they were brought into the professional ring. Now, recently, there have been medical studies of the effects of boxing. And one of the things that they've discovered is that the rotational blows to the skull made the brain rotate in such a way that there was, over time, significant neurological damage.
And we can hear it in someone like Muhammad Ali.
Yes, a high rate of Parkinson's disease,
right,
for example.
Right.
Now, this is, to me, typical of the difference between an acute and a chronic problem, the difference between a really acute blow that does very evident bloody damage and a series of repeated blows, none of which in itself is nearly as harmful, but which over time take a toll that is greater than a lifetime or a career's worth of bare-knuckle fighting.
Are you also saying that the development of the boxing glove changed the style of boxing so that it changed the way you hit your opponent?
Yes.
And thereby causing a different kind or more kind of damage?
Yes. I don't think at first that people were really aware of these things. It often takes decades to understand just what's going on after a technology has changed.
And then also, if you're talking about sports, there is the audience expectation of, as you said, boxing was trying to be designed to appeal to a middle-class audience. And there is this level of expectation, maybe even level of fight that people were looking for.
Yes, and that also applies in for example, sports where the helmets are used. The helmet can be used for spearing in football. It can be used as an offensive weapon. But in that case, you have a very dangerous load on the spinal column. So football can be more dangerous than rugby, which is played with a minimum of protective equipment, which has a lot of injuries, but they're not of nearly the serious kind that as football played with all of this padding.
Edward Tenner is the author of Why Things Bite Back. This is Fresh Air. This week on PBS, the documentary series POV winds up its latest season with a documentary on a turning point in the history of mass transportation, the point when trolley cars gave way to automobiles in big cities. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
I know I'm saying this on public radio, but that doesn't make it any less true. If it weren't for public television, the one-hour single-topic documentary would be all but dead. Oh, the commercial networks are cluttering up primetime with multi-topic news magazines, and cable outlets like CNN and HBO reserve time for extended nonfiction stuff. But if it's a regularly scheduled showcase you're after, the best place to go is PBS, which has both Frontline and POV. What these two shows have in common all the time is a respect for their audience. What they only have in common once in a while is a clear point of view. Usually, but not always, Frontline tries to remain objective. POV, as its title indicates, makes no such effort, which, a lot of the time, is what makes POV so distinctive. Already this season, POV has done a few truly fascinating shows, one on a local politician running in Massachusetts against a member of the Kennedy family, and another about a filmmaker who profiled a bunch of female rodeo riders, then decided to climb in the saddle and try it herself. This week, POV provides another, taken for a ride by filmmaker Jim Klein and researcher and co-producer Martha Olson. Their documentary takes dead aim at General Motors and takes on Detroit so forcefully and so persuasively that even Michael Moore, who took on a similar adversary in his film Roger and Me, would be impressed. This is one PBS documentary, trust me, that is not underwritten by your friends at General Motors. Instead, the show paints the early 20th century management of General Motors as major schemers who found a way to disrupt and destroy existing mass transit systems so they would have more room in the cities for more cars. The scam they perpetrated is so complex that Taken for a Ride makes it sound almost like a sequel to Chinatown. Only instead of diverting water to the desert, these fat cats were diverting trolleys from the major cities. It's not as though their schemes were unnoticed or even unpunished at the time. In federal court, General Motors eventually was found guilty of conspiracy to monopolize local transportation, and one of the biggest culprits was fined by the court. But the fine was $1. And in 1974, at a Senate antitrust committee hearing, San Francisco Mayor Joseph Alioto, arguing with Nebraska Republican Roman Huska, makes an eloquent case for how Americans were taken in by GM and its cohorts.
And I think the automobile industry is the number one example of monopoly power that has changed, literally changed the quality of our lives. And it has done so, not on the basis of what people really needed, but rather on the basis of serving corporate interests.
Was it General Motors that really wrecked the streetcar system in America?
The answer has got to be yes, because General Motors actually formed the company to go in to buy out these...
General Motors came into a situation where streetcars were inordinately inefficient. They were not flexible. Do you know of any streetcar system that could service San Francisco with all of its outlying communities and suburbs?
I am not an anti-automobile nut. I don't want to outlaw the automobile. I'm not suggesting it isn't a convenient way of traveling. I am suggesting that it must be supplemented by rapid transit systems. And I cannot accept the argument that rapid transit systems broke down because of their complete inefficiency to serve the public, because the experience of Western Europe and Japan belies that argument. And finally, Senator, I must say, with great deference, that if it is true that the streetcar companies were breaking down of their own weight, why was it necessary for General Motors to join with Standard Oil and the tire companies to go in and buy the systems and tear up the tracks?
Watching Taken for a Ride may leave you somewhat depressed, but the film ends on a hopeful note, pointing to a recently proposed solution for our urban gridlock problems. The solution? A new line of trolley cars.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Tracy Tenenbaum and Lawrence Donahue Green. Fresh Air is directed this week by Alan Tu. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowen.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
President Clinton says he will sign the new welfare bill. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from New York Times writer Jason DeParle, who covers issues of poverty and social welfare. DeParle will explain what changes we can expect from the new law. I'm Marty Moscowen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.